alone with so many of his crew locked in the hold. I offered to cast them overboard, but he wouldn't have it. I recall instructing you not to linger. Clay saw the woman avoid Heilmore's gaze as she pointed at the distant glow on the southern horizon. Took it as a sign we should wait a while longer. Besides, Akina thought it was pretty. Clay saw the pirate woman's daughter hovering nearby, though her eyes weren't fixed on the volcano, but on Chris. She had placed herself close to Clay's side, her expression a mix of guarded uncertainty and fascination as he drank in the sight of the superior.
"Who's this?"
Akina demanded, stabbing a finger at Chris, small features bunched in suspicion.
"She's new, and she looks wrong."
Clay saw the girl wasn't alone in her fascination. Several of the superior's crew were also staring at Chris.
"I'd guess you didn't find her at Craghurst Station," Zanita said to Heilmore.
"Her name's Chris," Clay said, matching the stares of the crew. "She's with me."
It's different, he realized, watching the uncertainty on their faces. Mostly they displayed a basic fear of the unfamiliar, mixed with a desire for this long, wearisome expedition to end. Before, it hadn't been like this. They'd all followed him across miles of ocean through many perils without any real question or reluctance. Now he saw many of them were asking themselves why. He had seen Heilmore and the others exhibit the same diminished faith in him on the Dreadfire, and had put it down to the extremity of their situation, but now saw it went deeper than that.
"Didn't you ever wonder why they were so willing to follow you?"
Silverpin's ghost had asked, making him understand that somehow he had cast a spell over these people, just as Silverpin had cast a spell on the Long Rifles during their search for the White. Now that spell was gone. Now he was just an unregistered bloodblessed from the blinds who had returned to them with something impossible. The answer came to him as Heilmore stepped forward, casting out a string of orders that had the crew rushing off to their allotted tasks, albeit with many a suspicious or baffled glance at Chris. Silverpin, Clay thought. Part of her lived on in me. The part that could compel the unblessed to follow me on the promise of little more than a waking dream. And I killed it when I killed what was left of her.
"Are you all right?"
Chris asked, and he realized his face must have betrayed his thoughts.
"Just fine," he lied, forcing a smile.
"But I think we got us a long and trying trip ahead."
Crystalline Lake?
Zanita's face betrayed a curious mix of amusement and foreboding.
"That's where we're going."
Heilmore had convened a meeting in the superior's wardroom. He stood at the map table, face scraped clean of his previously copious beard, and wearing a fresh uniform. Although Clay thought the captain had weathered the depredations of the ice better than all of them, the uniform still hung loose in several places, though Heilmore stood as straight as ever. Braddon and Chris were the only others present besides Clay and Zanita.
"You know it?"
the captain asked the Verestian woman.
"I know of it, as I should. My father died there."
Zanita gave a rueful grimace as she surveyed the map, a more detailed rendering of the South Aradsian coastal region than that offered by the antique maps of long-dead Captain Bledthorn.
"The last of his many foolish and expensive jaunts in search of mythical treasures. I never knew what truly became of him. He went off exploring and never came back. I hoped to go looking for him myself one day, but the pressures of commerce always prevented me. And I had a daughter to think of."
Clay opened Scriberson's notebook as something chimed in his memory. Thanks to the leather binding, the pages hadn't been ruined when he dropped his pack in the sea. "Mr. O," he said, after finding the series of entries that corresponded to their journey across the lake. "The River Maiden was charted by a Mr. O."
"For Okanus."
Zanita frowned at him, her gaze fixed on the notebook.
"What is that?"
A dead man's journal, Braddon said, before going on to relate the story of their time on Crystalline Lake. It was Dr. Furpike who had the most interest in it. Pity we left all his papers in the grave where we buried him in the Coppersoles. Looks like scribes took plenty of notes, Clay said, continuing to leaf through the book. Guessing he didn't trust Furpike to share what he knew later on. He stopped as he came to a particular notation, a line of text underscored with the words, Translated Dalcian Text, Early Satura Magisterium. A vessel of wonder, Clay read aloud. Unbound by earth or sea, come to rest with precious cargo neath the silver waters. He raised his gaze to Zenita. You have any notion what it all means? Relations between my father and I were poor in the 3 years before his disappearance. I know that he spent the better part of 2 years paying out a good portion of his wealth to an artificer, a renegade Corventine who had a design for an apparatus that would enable a man to breathe underwater. So whatever he was after will not be easy to reach. The location would be marked on one of his many maps, but they are all locked away in the family archive at the High Wall.
Furpike said the story came from a Dalcian legend, Braddon said, brow creased as he strove to recollect the details. Close to 3,000 years old, he said. Clay turned to Chris. Seems too recent to be Hezki.
The legend may be 3,000 years old, she said, but the story that inspired it could be much older. And we don't know exactly when he woke. He could have been sleeping for centuries.
Clay sighed as Anita and Braddon squinted at Chris in bafflement.
It's a really long story, Clay began.
Chris yelped and shrank back as the flames consumed the candle in one fierce blast of heat, leaving a patch of dripping wax on the stern rail.
I don't get why you ain't better at this,
Clay said, watching her straighten quickly, smoothing a hand through her hair in an effort to cover her embarrassment.
You can fashion a crystal into a rose, but you can't light a candle with red. Red plasma was never my speciality, she said, somewhat stiffly. The blessing, as you call it, was only marginally understood in my time. Your people have had centuries of practice. As for the crystals, they were much more easily manipulated than other material. It was almost like they wanted to be altered.
We'll try again.
Clay took a box from his pocket and extracted a single match. Something smaller might work better, he said, setting it down on the rail and stepping back.
Concentrate on the head. The fire goes where your eyes go. You can feel it, right?
The red in your veins.
Try to think of it as a barrel, full of power. You only need to let out a little at a time.
Chris kept her gaze locked on the match, frowning in concentration. Clay was soon gratified to see a slight heat shimmer appear between her and the rail, just as the match head flared into life. The fire was still too fierce, consuming the match in a fraction of a second to leave a speck of black ash on the rail, but it was her most controlled effort so far.
I want to try again, Chris said. Something bigger.
The captain's got us on a strict product ration, Clay said. No more than a few drops at a time, just for practice.
This ship truly runs on red plasma, she asked, casting her eyes over the frigate's upper works.
Didn't think we had just sailing ships, did you?
From her slightly chagrined expression, he saw that she had in fact been thinking that very thing. Although they had shared much in the trance, it was clear they still understood relatively little about each other and the eras that had produced them.
Contempt, Mr. Torcreek,
Sigurd had said, during their sojourn through the strange world down below.
That's what she thinks of us. To her, we are just useful primitives.
It's called a thermoplasmic engine, he said, watching closely to gauge her reaction.
Just a vial or two of red is enough to shift this whole ship at a right old lick. And she's a tiddler compared to some.
Remarkable,
Chris murmured, though her gaze darkened as it alighted on the rear gun battery.
So much progress, and yet you're still fighting wars.
It's a big world. Guess there's a lot to fight over. They both turned in unison as an upsurge of shouting came from the deck of the Farlight, moored some 50 yards to port. It was still early, as Halmore wanted to wait for a fully risen sun before commencing the voyage north. However, there was ample light to make out the tall spines cutting through the whirls towards the three ships. Although the Blue Hunter's crew had been warned that Jack no longer posed a threat and might appear at some point, it seemed their long-held instincts were not so easily assuaged. Clay saw a group of sailors feverishly loading the ship's forward harpoon cannon, as others formed up along the side with rifles in hand. Lesson number 2, Clay said, opening his wallet and extracting a vial of black. How to stop a missile in flight. The harpoon cannon fired just as Jack raised his head above the water, blinking in apparent amusement at the sight of the huge barbed length of iron as it hovered in midair a few yards away. Clay knew he was showing off and burning more product than he should, but it wasn't just Chris who needed to learn a lesson. The harpoon gave a loud squeal as Clay twisted the arrowhead point back at a sharp angle. The crew on the Farlight could only stare in shock and then duck as he hurled the projectile back at them. It slammed into the Blue Hunter's stack with sufficient force to leave a sizable dent. Clay cupped his hands around his mouth, raising his voice to full volume.
Any of you fuckers cast so much as a nasty look in his direction again, and I won't blunt it next time!
He heard a faint hiss of steam, and turned to see Jack letting out a contented puff of flame as he slipped below the water. Chapter 7. Lizanne. She exhausted most of her green rowing to the aerostat, the oars blurring like paddles as they propelled the launch through the choppy sea. By the time they reached the craft, it had settled on the waves, the boat-like gondola bobbing on the swell and sinking ever lower as water lapped over its shallow sides. Above, the elongated gas-filled balloon swayed in the wind, threatening to twist the ropes that bound it into a tangle that would no doubt see it fall and the whole craft subside along with it into the ocean. It appeared to have been fashioned from overlapping panels of silk, which fluttered as the gas inside grew thinner by the second. There were three people in the gondola, and the sight of them flooded Lizanne with a relief that made her pause in her labor, though it was shot through with an awful realization.
Father, Jemiah, Tekela, no Aunt Pendilla.
Get a rope over there,
she commanded the two burly sailors at the front of the launch. They duly cast a weighted rope to the gondola as the ensign at the tiller steered them alongside. The last of Lizanne's green gave out as she closed the distance between the two craft. She slumped in her seat, chest heaving thanks to the effects of burning so much product so quickly. So she barely heard the thump and clatter of feet on the boards, sitting with her aching head bowed and chest thumping like a drum.
Lizanne!
She raised her head as a pair of soft hands met her cheeks, looking up to find herself confronted by a familiar, doll-like countenance, albeit one that seemed to have suddenly become much more womanly in expression, if not form.
It is very good to see you again, miss,
Lizanne said with a tired smile. Tekela's face blossomed into a smile of her own, tears welling in her eyes, and she pressed a kiss to Lizanne's forehead before pulling her into a tight embrace. Lizanne swallowed, her throat hard and tight.
My aunt?
Tekela drew back, tears falling as she shook her head.
I'm sorry. It was horrible.
She trailed off, face clouded with confusion and unwanted memories.
Cirrus. Cirrus was there. What? He was there, changed, spoiled, but it was him. He saved me.
The resurrection of a youth Lizanne had last seen strapped into a chair and apparently dead in a Corventine torture chamber was a singular mystery, but one that would have to wait, as would her grief.
The box, Lizanne said. Do you still have the box?
Takela had deposited two bulky objects on the deck of the launch. One was wrapped in waxed canvas against the damp, but Lizanne could make out a familiar, if much reduced, shape under the covering.
Jemiah's been busy, I see.
She turned to the other object, also concealed in canvas. Takela crouched and pulled the wrapping away to reveal a familiar, shiny box-shaped device of numerous cogs and gears.
Good, Lizanne said. Keep it close.
Takela's eyes widened in surprise.
You want me to look after it? You seem to have done a fair job so far. I assume that thing works.
She added, nudging the other object with her toe.
600 rounds a minute on the slowest setting,
Takela replied, face suddenly grim with no doubt ugly remembrance.
It works very well. No, young man, I will not abandon this craft.
Her father's voice tore her gaze from Takela. Jemiah had already clambered onto the launch, but the esteemed Professor Grayson Lethbridge stood resolute on the rapidly descending deck of his latest invention.
Do you have any notion of the import of this device?
He demanded of the ensign.
I insist you see to its salvage.
Lizanne stood, moving on unsteady legs to slump against the side of the boat, staring at her father until he met her gaze, not without some reluctance. She saw his resolve falter, but not completely.
It's important, he said,
a faint pleading note in his voice.
Surely you can see that.
Lizanne gave an involuntary roll of her eyes, which she knew must have made her resemble a sulky adolescent, but found herself too weary to care.
He's right, she told the ensign. Lash the launch to it, then use your flags to signal the profitable for more boats.
He began to protest, but she waved a dismissive hand.
Exceptional initiatives. Just get on with it, unless you'd like to be posted to a research station in the northern polar region.
She assumed either Varix put a great deal more weight on her authority than she really deserved, or Director Thriftmore intervened again. In either case, the profitable venture soon came to an almost complete stop, raising flags and blasting her sirens to order the rest of the convoy to follow suit. Within minutes, the cruiser's 20-foot steam-powered pinnace had been lowered over the side and was making a steady progress towards the floundering aerostat. Her father and Jemiah used a valve on the balloon's underside to vent the remaining gas, provoking a worried question from Lizanne as the pinnace drew alongside.
Isn't it flammable? Helium, Jemiah said. Take more than a spark to set it off. Tried a few experiments with hydrogen, but they nearly burned the shop down. Helium is more plentiful in any case,
her father added,
and cheaper.
Soon the balloon was just a flaccid sprawl of wet silk on the water. Professor Lethbridge ordered it gathered up whilst Jemiah oversaw the recovery of the gondola.
Not so much the carriage we need, he said,
slapping a hand to a bulky cylindrical apparatus at the rear of the gondola.
It's the engine.
The thermoplasmic? Lizanne asked, recognizing the telltale pipework visible through a gap in the engine's carapace.
It's a hybrid,
Jemiah replied, and she saw the glimmer of professional pride in his eyes.
Kerosene or blood? Both burn in the same combustion chamber. She'll give out more power if you feed her red, of course, but kerosene is fine for basic maneuvering.
Speed? Lizanne inquired, receiving a reply from an unexpected source.
I had her up to 30 miles per hour using kerosene,
Takela said.
We hadn't yet managed to conduct a trial with blood.
Lizanne scowled at Jemiah.
You let her fly this thing? She's our test pilot,
he answered with a grin, far too lacking in contrition for Lazanne's liking.
We weren't too sure about the lifting properties at first. Needed someone who wouldn't weigh her down. Takayla volunteered. Got a right good feel for the controls, too.
Lazanne shifted her baleful gaze to her father.
I told you to find her a decent school, not subject her to your experiments.
We did, Professor Lethbridge replied. Miss Hisselwick's finishing academy. She wouldn't go. Your aunt tried to march her there, but she fought her off, then threatened to run off and live in the refugee camp. Lazanne rounded on Takayla, who met her angry visage with a shrug and a purse of her lips.
I'm too old for school anyway.
And too young to be careening around the sky in one of his mad contraptions.
Well, you gave him the plans.
A small vestige of the old Takayla appeared then, pouty and defiant in the face of legitimate concern. At this juncture, Lazanne wasn't sure if she preferred that Takayla to this one. At least the brat had been predictable, up to a point. Lazanne took a calming breath and turned back to her father, as he helped drag the last of the depleted balloon onto the foredeck of the pinnace.
If you're quite finished, we need to return, she said. You'll also have to provide a full account of Pharos's fall to Captain Verex and Director Thriftmore. It seems we have some more hard decisions to make.
Soon the pinnace had closed to within about 100 yards of the profitable. The helmsman steered hard to port to bring the craft alongside as a group of sailors gathered at the lower deck rail, ready to cast off their securing lines. It was then that Lazanne felt a small hand clutch at her arm, and turned to see Takayla, face pale and eyes wide as she pointed at something in the sky. The Drake was high enough to be out of range of the Profitable's guns, but the angle of the sun drew a faint red glitter from its scales as it banked and turned for the east. Lazanne went to the junior lieutenant commanding the pinnace and demanded his spyglass before training it on the eastern horizon. An enemy in sight signal was already blasting from the Profitable's sirens by the time she picked out the telltale silhouettes resolving through the morning mist. Warships. There were 5 of them, all either frigate or sloop class. She saw what at first appeared to be a thick pall of smoke rising from each of the ships, then realized it to be a swarm of drakes.
Change of orders,
Lazanne said, returning the spyglass to the lieutenant.
Make for the viable opportunity. Tell Captain Trumaine to head east at best possible speed and signal the rest of the fleet to follow. He is not to linger for any reason.
She stared at his blanched, near-panicked features until he gave a nod of assent.
What are you doing?
Her father asked as she moved to the prow of the pinnace.
I left something behind.
Lazanne climbed onto the prow and took out her wallet, extracting a vial of green and exchanging it for the exhausted one in the spider, before injecting all of it along with a 1/4 vial of red. She would need it to ward off the chill. She glanced back, seeing Takayla struggling in Jemiah's grip as she sought to follow.
Take care of her,
Lazanne said, before diving into the sea. The Profitable's main batteries were firing as she scaled the stern anchor mounting and vaulted onto the lower deck. The cruiser's guns fired according to a preset sequence, so as not to buckle the ship's structure with the release of so much energy at once. The resultant roar was therefore continuous and deafening, drowning out the cacophony of shouted orders as the crew scrambled to their battle stations. The Profitable's blood burners came online when she made her way onto the mid-deck, the ship lurching into accelerated motion as Mr. and Mrs. Griffin lit the product in her dual engines. Apart from their brief and distressing sojourn through the revolution-torn streets of Corvus, neither of the Griffins had been in battle before, and Lazanne had to suppress a pang of sympathy for what they were about to experience.
They are not your mission.
She was obliged to struggle past a throng of rushing sailors to get to the officers' quarters, opening the door of Tinkerer's cabin to find him lying on the deck,
just as she had instructed. He stared up at her with bright eyes, though his face was typically lacking in animation. She noticed he also had a small bottle clutched in his hand.
"I stole it from the ship's medical bay," he explained, following her gaze. "Potassium chloride. You said to seek out the most efficient means."
"Best hold on to it for now," she said.
"Get up. We're leaving."
She led him to Macario's cabin, where she found the musician playing a surprisingly jaunty tune on his flute.
"Thought I'd prefer my death to be accompanied by something cheerful," he said.
"It'll have to wait. Follow me and don't dawdle." She led them both to the corridor leading to the middle of the ship, where they could scale a ladder all the way to the lower deck. They were halfway down the ladder when the ship gave a sudden, violent shudder. A loud, high-pitched groan of protesting metal echoed all around.
"That doesn't sound good,"
Macario observed, holding onto the ladder with a white-knuckled grip.
"She's been hit,"
Lazanne said, continuing to climb down.
"And it won't be for the last time. Keep going."
On descending to the lower deck, she started for the stern, dodging around sailors laden with equipment and ammunition. The ship heaved several times as they made their way aft, Lazanne deducing that Captain Verex had thrown the Profitable into a series of evasive maneuvers. Even through the thick iron bulkheads and continuing roar of the main batteries, she could hear a familiar rapid percussive thump and growl.
"Secondary armament," she realized. "The Drakes must be close."
The pale rectangle of an open hatch appeared ahead, and she started forward at a run, then came to a sudden halt as the ceiling buckled, the metal tearing open to flood the corridor with smoke and flame. Thanks to the green in her veins, Lazanne recovered quickly, the ringing in her ears and blurred vision subsiding after only seconds. Macario and Tinkerer were not so lucky. The musician required several hard slaps before he regained enough sensibility to stand, whilst Tinkerer remained unconscious, though mercifully free of injury.
"Did you have to bring him?"
Macario inquired, as Lazanne hauled the artificer's slight form onto her shoulders.
"Just be grateful I brought you."
She was obliged to step over the mangled remains of several sailors before reaching the hatch, stepping out into the open air to find the stern of the Profitable Venture in shambles. It appeared the cruiser had been hit by at least 4 shells from a salvo of 5. One of the rear batteries was a complete wreck, the armored housing shattered, and the gun crew transformed into charred lumps of flesh. 2 large holes had been punched into the deck from which smoke issued forth in copious amounts. The surrounding ironwork glowed a deep red as the inferno beneath raged unchecked. It was clear that her original plan to make for the aft lifeboats was now out of the question.
"By the souls of all the emperors,"
Macario breathed as a large winged form soared through the smoke. The red gave a brief squawk before opening its talons, allowing something to tumble free of its grip. A man-sized, man-shaped something. The spoiled landed directly in front of Lazanne, no more than 3 feet away. Time seemed to slow then, thanks to the green, which had a tendency to increase perception in times of great stress. Therefore, Lazanne was able to discern a great deal about the spoiled in the space of the next few heartbeats. She saw that it was male, stood an inch or two over 6 feet in height, and appeared to be wearing a greatly modified version of a uniform normally worn by Protectorate infantry. Various trinkets had been sewn into the uniform's tunic, cap badges from Protectorate and Corventine regiments, along with what were unmistakably human teeth and other more fleshy tokens. It also carried a .35 Dessinger long-barrel service revolver in one clawed hand, and a tribal war club of some kind in the other. She even had time to look into its eyes, and be left with absolutely no doubt that it was about to do its best to kill her.
"Catch!"
Lazanne told the spoiled, and threw Tinkerer's unconscious body at it. Doing the utterly unexpected was a tactic that had worked for her in the past. and so it proved now. The spoiled nimbly caught Tinkerer in its arms and wasted a few precious seconds staring at Lazanne, its spined brow creasing in bafflement. She drew her revolver from her skirt pocket and shot it in the eye. At least they die like a human, she thought, bending to retrieve Tinkerer's body. Take that, she told Macario, nodding at the spoiled's fallen revolver. Macario was blinking rapidly, face white with shock. It seemed even the depredations of Skorzin hadn't prepared him for this. I don't like guns. Just pick it up. She turned and carried Tinkerer towards midships, keeping to the walkway that fringed the lower starboard deck. She passed several thumper and growler batteries, the crews casting a flaming torrent of tracer into the sky at the reds that now seemed to be everywhere. She had the satisfaction of seeing one drake torn apart by a concentrated blast from a thumper, before it could deposit the two spoiled in its claws on the deck. Sadly, the thumper crew's cheers were short-lived, as another much larger red swooped down through the cloud of gore left by its fallen brother, and doused the jubilant sailors in a thick stream of fire. Lizanne closed her ears to the screams and ran on. On reaching the ladder that led to the starboard lifeboat derricks, they were confronted by the sight of a vicious hand-to-hand melee between sailors and spoiled. At least 20 were assailing each other, rifle butts and bayonets against war clubs and hatchets. Lazanne was struck by the unnaturally coordinated movements of the spoiled as they fought, one ducking a swinging rifle butt, whilst its comrade stepped forward to dispatch the sailor who had delivered it, whereupon they both stepped aside in unison to dodge a bayonet charge. It was like some form of dreadful murderous dance, and proved dishearteningly effective. Within what seemed like seconds, all the sailors lay dead or dying, whilst the spoiled had only lost 3 of their number. Lizanne heard Macario let out a shocked gasp, as the spoiled all turned to regard the pair of them. There were a dozen, uniform in their silence, if not their appearance, but betraying slight head movements that indicated inner thoughts. Not thoughts, Lizanne decided, seeing the spoiled suddenly take on a more purposeful stance, as if some unspoken decision had been reached. Communication. What do we do now? Macario asked, as the spoiled started forward. Fight! What else? Lizanne shrugged Tinkerer from her shoulder and pushed him into Macario's arms. Guard him! She had time to inject half a vial of red and black before the spoiled closed, fanning out with pistols raised. Lizanne released most of her black at once, blasting the spoiled off their feet, then rushed forward to methodically shoot 5 of them in the head in quick succession as they lay on the deck. The remaining 7 were up quickly, and immediately began their deadly dance, circling her with frustrating speed and loosing off shots with their revolvers that forced her into a leap. She tumbled in midair over the head of one of the spoiled, unleashing red as she did so. The spoiled's mismatched garb of Corventine uniform and island tribal gear caught light immediately, though his scaly hide proved more resistant to the flames. He swung his war club at her as she landed, forcing her to backpedal and use all her remaining black to propel his flaming body over the side and into the sea. Another spoiled loomed out of the smoke left by his comrade's departure, pistol leveled at her head, too close to dodge. Something boomed behind Lizanne, and a hole appeared between the spoiled's eyes as a crimson plume exploded from the back of his skull. Lizanne darted forward to retrieve the fallen spoiled's revolver, then turned to see Macario hunched against the bulkhead, flaming pistol in hand. The musician held Tinkerer's inert form to his chest in the manner of a human shield, meeting Lizanne's gaze with a tremulous grin. I said I didn't like them, he told her. Not that I couldn't use them. Lizanne whirled away, feeling the whoosh of a war club as it passed close to her head. Sending her assailant reeling with a blast of red at his eyes, she followed up with a quick shot to his chest, then leapt again. Bullets buzzed around her as she twisted in midair, green enhanced reflexes given full rein as she targeted each of the remaining spoiled, felling them all with single shots to the head before her feet met the deck. She crouched, shuddering as the last of the green faded from her veins, then looked up at the thump of several large bodies hitting the walkway. She let out a tired groan at the sight of what now confronted her. It appeared the Red's cargo didn't just consist of spoiled. The trio of greens spent a brief moment sniffing the smoky air, before fixing their gaze on her and immediately charging, jaws gaping wide as they summoned their flames. If there had been any green left, she might have been able to leap over the drakes at the last moment. But there was no green, so all she could do was inject her remaining red and black, hoping to match their flames with her own, but knowing it wouldn't be enough. Flames began to blossom from the mouth of the leading green as it closed to within a dozen feet, whereupon it was lifted off its claws and propelled into a nearby iron support beam with enough force to break its spine. Flames engulfed the two remaining greens as they whirled to the left to meet the new threat, Lizanne turning to see a slender, soot-covered figure emerge from a hatchway. Sophia Griffin seemed to have suddenly acquired a demonic aspect, her face like a mask of white and black, and her unbound red hair flowing as she advanced on the greens, the air around her shimmering with unleashed heat. Lizanne marveled at the amount of red she must have ingested, far more than was normally considered safe, judging by the intensity of the fire she cast at the greens. The heat was sufficient to blacken even their fire-resistant hides, causing both to scamper back, squealing in distress in a manner that was almost piteous. Mrs. Griffin, however, appeared to have lost all capacity for pity. Having forced the pair of greens to the edge of the walkway, she unleashed her black, tearing the limbs from their torsos, their screams multiplying as the unabated flames met exposed flesh. Even then, she wasn't done, advancing to stand over the writhing creatures as she tore ever more flesh from their bones, until the screams finally fell silent, and they were no more than blackened, twitching husks on the deck. Sophia collapsed as Lizanne rushed to her side. She was saying something, lips moving in a faint whisper, as she sang a soft tune Lizanne recognized as an old Mandalorian nursery rhyme.
"Eat, eat, eat it all up, or you'll get no pudding today."
"Mrs. Griffin,"
Lizanne said, shaking the woman's shoulder. There was no response, save the continual repetition of the same whispered words.
"Eat, eat, eat it all up, or..."
"Sophia!"
Lizanne shook her again, hard enough to force the other woman to turn. Sophia Griffin blinked at her blankly for several long seconds until recognition dawned.
"Miss Lethbridge,"
Sophia said, her voice possessed of a calm that seemed completely out of keeping with their present circumstance.
"They ate my husband. Ate him all up."
Lizanne glanced back at the hatch from which Sophia had emerged. It led to the engines, but from the thickness of the smoke billowing from below, Lizanne had serious doubts anyone would still be alive down there. She rose, peering through the acrid, billowing fog at the sea beyond the walkway. She could see one of the enemy ships burning, a frigate drifting in a lazy circle as tall flames consumed her superstructure. From the speed at which the wreck passed by the profitable starboard beam, it was clear that whatever conflagration raged beneath the cruiser's decks, the blood burners were still operating at full power. Lizanne went to the rail and leaned out, squinting at the sea beyond the bows. Through the haze, she could see two more warships, bright flashes on the foredecks, and the whine of approaching shot indicating they were still very much in this fight. The fact that the Profitable was heading straight for the ships told her the cruiser was still answering the helm, and Captain Verex was resolved to see this through to the end.
"He's buying time," she realized,
turning about and shielding her eyes to scan the eastern horizon. The refugee fleet were dim shapes in the haze now, growing dimmer as they piled on the steam to complete their escape. Time for them, but none for us.
Come with me,
she said, moving to grasp Sophia by the arm, pulling her upright and tugging her along. Lizanne found Macario propping Tinkra up against the bulkhead.
I think he's coming round,
he said, catching sight of Lizanne.
Let's see.
She delivered a hard slap to Tinkra's jaw, provoking a groan and a vague blink of his eyes. Several more slaps were sufficient to return him to consciousness.
Please stop that,
he said, as Lizanne drew her hand back for another blow.
We can't carry you any further, she said. Follow and stay close.
Fortunately, Sophia seemed to have subsided into a state of dumb compliance, which made it easy to lead her to the ladder and down to the lifeboat derricks.
Oh, bother!
Lizanne exclaimed, viewing the shattered and blackened remnants of the boats she had hoped to find.
There!
Macario said, pointing to the end of the row, where a single boat, smaller than the others, lay apparently unscathed, if somewhat charred. They rushed to it and climbed in, Lizanne checking to ensure it was equipped with oars, before turning her attention to the lowering mechanism.
Won't someone have to get out and wind it?
Macario asked, his tone indicating a marked reluctance to volunteer. From above came the grinding whistle of an approaching shell, followed by a deafening explosion.
I doubt we have the leisure for that,
Lizanne said, pulling Sophia into a protective huddle as debris rained down about them. When the cascade stopped, she focused her gaze on the ropes from which the lifeboat was suspended.
Hold on,
she said, and used the last vestiges of her red to burn the ropes away. The lifeboat plummeted 10 feet to the water, impacting with sufficient force to tip Tinkerer over the side, though Macario was quick to catch hold of his flailing arms.
Do you have any green?
Lizanne asked Sophia, after she and Macario had hauled the sputtering artificer back on board. Mrs. Griffin offered a blank stare in response, before shrugging her slim shoulders.
Never mind.
Lizanne turned to Macario and Tinkerer.
Take the oars. I'll steer.
Their two male companions proved to be inexpert but enthusiastic rowers, their efforts spurred on by a series of explosions that racked the profitable from end to end as they drew away. Lizanne set the tiller to an easterly course, then turned to watch the profitable as it closed on the two enemy frigates. The huge cruiser's forward guns kept up a steady barrage as she charged on, Lizanne estimating her speed at close to 40 knots. Shell after shell tore into her upper works, transforming much of the superstructure into a mangled mass of twisted, smoking metal. Judging from the bodies littering the sea, the ship's growlers and thumpers had taken a fearful toll on the attacking Reds, and only half a dozen remained to torment her, swooping down to cast their flames at the sailors, who fought back with rifle fire to little effect. Still, the profitable came on, her return fire becoming more accurate as the range diminished. One of the frigates took a full salvo amidships, birthing an instantaneous explosion that tore the warship in two. The stern section sank almost immediately, whilst the bows rolled over and lingered on the surface for a short time, Lizanne seeing the ant-like figures of men clinging to the hull.
Not men,
she reminded herself, watching the wreck sink beneath the waves amidst a roiling froth of foam, and hoping every single member of her inhuman crew drowned along with her. The profitable changed course, angling her stern towards the sole remaining enemy ship, sirens blaring a salute to what Lizanne knew would be her final act. Chapter 8. Cirrus. He could feel them drowning. Over 200 spoiled were on the losing proposition, and most of them survived the explosion that ignited her magazine and tore her in two. So Cirrus was given a fulsome education in the experience of convulsive gasping, as salt water invaded throat and lungs. Even amongst the spoiled, panic would take over at the end, subjugated human instincts reborn at the instant of death. The resultant blossom of terror and desperation should have been repugnant, something to slam his mental shields against. Instead, he drank it all in. Fear, he had come to understand, was a precious commodity. He could use this. Constant exposure to a life of horrors was creating an ever thicker callus around his soul, eroding his capacity to feel anything. When his own reserves of fear were depleted now, he could summon the memories of the dead to guard his mind. This he did now as he sent a silent pulse of thanks into the fading minds of the spoiled as they slipped into the depths. The losing proposition had been the fastest and least damaged ship in their small fleet. Her original name of the Negotiator scraped from her hull and replaced by something more to Kathleen's liking. It transpired that the blood-blessed woman had a flair for the ironic. Cirrus's command ship, a heavy frigate once dubbed the IPV Position of Strength, was now the Imminent Demise, a name that seemed increasingly appropriate as the huge Protectorate battleship loomed ever larger in the bridge window.
"Hard to starboard!"
he commanded aloud to the spoiled at the helm, simultaneously sending a thought command to the engine room.
"Reverse starboard paddle!"
The Imminent Demise veered away as the battleship came on, paddles turning the sea to foam on either side of her hull. Despite the damage that had wrecked much of her upper works, the fire of the battleship's forward batteries continued unabated. Cirrus had ordered the guns seized by the spoiled the Reds had deposited on the ship, but resistance from the Protectorate crew had been ferocious. Consequently, all but a handful from an assault force of over 50 had been killed. They had succeeded in dispatching over twice their number in the savage fighting that raged throughout the ship, but a vessel this size had plenty of crewmen in reserve. Cirrus felt sure that one of his squads, all veterans of the Barrier Isles campaign, would have succeeded in silencing the guns if they hadn't encountered the Lethbridge woman. Cirrus's mind had been fully occupied with marshalling his fleet against the battleship and her fearsomely accurate guns, but the rush of recognition experienced by the spoiled boarding party had cut through the competing morass of image and sensation. Lizanne Lethbridge's face had been plucked from the memory of one of the few exceptional initiatives agents captured at Pharos and seared into the mind of every spoiled by Kathleen herself. The image had been accompanied by an implacable instruction.
"Kill this woman on sight."
They had certainly tried, Cirrus taking charge of the squad and orchestrating an assault that should have left Miss Lethbridge a bullet-riddled corpse. The notion of summoning a burst of fear to mask his mind and allow her to escape fluttered through his head, but he resisted it. Recognition of this woman had spread throughout the fleet and across the many miles to Pharos. Kathleen would know. In the event, no subterfuge was necessary. Cirrus had faced many formidable people in battle before. Wickedly skilled island warriors, the Shaman King, and grizzled Protectorate veterans during his warship-seizing operations. But watching this woman as she leapt and shot, utilizing her powers with an economy and ferocity that was truly frightening, he knew he was looking upon the most dangerous individual he was ever likely to meet. He had come close, however. His soul remaining spoiled might actually have done the deed if Lethbridge's companion hadn't intervened. The woman's face disappeared into instant blackness as the bullet tore through the spoiled's brain, and Cirrus felt a painful howl of frustration filling his mind. The connection to his fellow spoiled was lost as the howl continued, accompanied by a lacerating fury as Kathleen gave full vent to her feelings.
"Sink that fucking ship, Admiral!"
her mind boomed in his head.
"Whatever the cost, I want that bitch dead!"
He had organized his ships into a broad semicircle, the two more lightly armed sloops at either end, and heavily armed frigates in the center. The whole affair would have been over fairly quickly if a sufficient number of blues had been with them, But it transpired the aquatic drakes were unable to keep pace with steam-powered ships for more than a few hours at a time. Consequently, their accompanying force of 24 blues were nowhere in sight when the Protectorate fleet hove into view, obliging Cirrus to fight the battle with the forces on hand. He ordered the 2 sloops to use their superior speed to dart close to the battleship, loose off a rapid salvo, then withdraw so as to divide the enemy's fire, whilst the frigate's barrage did most of the damage. All the while the Reds conducted harassing dives on the battleship, sweeping her decks with fire. It had been an effective, if costly, tactic so far. Most of the Reds had fallen to the battleship's deadly repeating guns, and a sloop and a frigate had been destroyed, thanks to sheer weight of gunnery. But it was working. The big ship could only take so much more, despite her captain's impressive maneuvering and the desperate courage of her crew. All they had to do was draw back a mile or so, and let her exhaust her reserves of product before closing in for the kill. But with Kathleen's command, the time for tactical niceties was over. Cirrus ordered his 3 remaining ships into a tight formation and launched them head-on at the battleship. The other sloop went down first, striking out in the lead, only to be caught by a mixture of heavy and light armament when she drew within 400 yards of the enemy. Both her paddles were wrecked within minutes, and her boiler exploded as she foundered. The losing proposition went next, felled by a lucky plunging shot to the magazine, which left the imminent demise to face the dying monster alone.
"Midships!"
Cirrus ordered as the frigate's bow swung north. He sent a command to the engine room to set both paddles into forward motion, but a glance through the side window told him it wouldn't be enough. The battleship loomed over the smaller vessel as the 2 ships closed, the repeating guns on the Protectorate ship raking the imminent demise from stern to bow. Cirrus dived to the deck as cannon shells and bullets tore the bridge apart, showering him with shattered glass and timber. He felt the ship heave to port and looked up to see the helmsman lying nearby. A cannon shell appeared to have punched clean through the spoiled, and he lay gazing at the smoke rising from the hole in his chest, yellow eyes curious rather than afraid. Cirrus tore his gaze from the sight and scrambled upright, lurching towards the wheel in the vain hope he might correct the ship's course whilst she could still make headway. He was propelled off his feet before he could reach it, the entire ship racked by a mighty shudder as the battleship rammed into her port beam at full speed. Ironworks screamed in protest as the huge ship's prow tore into the guts of the imminent demise, steam exploding up through the sundered deck as her boiler burst. For a moment, it seemed as if the battleship would slice the frigate clean in 2, but then her velocity suddenly diminished. Cirrus assumed due to her blood burners finally exhausting their fuel. He had been thrown clear of the wrecked bridge and found himself clinging to the starboard railing. The sea seemed to be heaving around him, and he realized the 2 ships were now locked together in a mad dance. The frigate's starboard paddle was still turning, and the battleship had brought her auxiliary engines online, forcing the 2 vessels into an erratic pirouette, as neither had sufficient power to break free of the other. However, a quick scan of the minds of his remaining crew told Cirrus the imminent demise would soon live up to its name. The impact had torn a gaping rent in the porthole plating, and several tons of water had already deluged the hold and the ballast tanks. She would go under in minutes.
"Sink it!"
Kathleen's voice in his head, shrill and undeniable in its compulsion.
"Kill her!"
Cirrus found a pair of spoiled crewmen attempting to shore up the hull, and sent them to the magazine instead. He also found a drowning spoiled trapped beneath an iron beam in engineering. The man had been an armorer on a Protectorate vessel before his capture, and it was an easy matter to pluck the required knowledge from his head before the rising waters claimed his final breath. Cirrus instantly shared the knowledge with the 2 spoiled in the magazine. They completed the task with the kind of efficiency only the spoiled could display,
pushing the detonators into the sacks of propellant and rigging the fuses in a scant few minutes. Cirrus clambered back onto the listing deck of his short-lived command, gazing up at the prow of the battleship above. The profitable venture, he read from the iron-lettered plate behind the great ship's anchor mounting. Not today, it seems. A bullet ricocheted off the bulkhead a few feet away as a Protectorate marksman tried his luck. Cirrus ignored it, instead focusing his gaze on the tallest figure he could see amongst the riflemen assembled along the battleship's rail. Whether the man was the captain, or even an officer, he couldn't tell. But Cirrus straightened and offered a perfect salute nevertheless. It seemed only polite. He never knew if the man returned the salute, for at that moment, Kathleen's thoughts pushed their way into his.
Very noble, I'm sure, Admiral. But we still have need of you. Time for a swim.
This command was no more resistible than the others, and Cirrus turned and sprinted for the starboard rail without pause, chased all the way by Protectorate rifle fire. He leapt over the rail and dived into the sea, plunging deep and staying below the surface as he swam away. The magazine blew when he had covered perhaps 20 yards. The blast wave would probably have killed a non-spoiled, forcing the remaining air from his lungs and propelling him to the surface, his back arched like a bow. Air flooded his lungs as he reared up out of the water, floundering for a brief time, before his instinctive panic receded. He let the fear linger as he bobbed on the surface, gazing at the final moments of the two warships. The explosion had torn the imminent demise free of her ugly embrace with the larger vessel, and she foundered quickly, Cirrus once again sharing the final agonies of a drowning crew. The profitable venture took longer to die. The explosion had torn away most of her prow, revealing the corridors and compartments of her innards. Smoke and flame gouted from deep within her, then died as the decks flooded. Her stern reared up as the forward section became inundated, a massive rudder turning this way and that, like the tail of some huge wounded fish. The battleship emitted a last forlorn groan as she sank, men dropping from her flanks, like flies escaping a submerging corpse. Then the rudder slipped into the patch of frothing sea, and she was gone. Night seemed to fall quickly, though his sense of time slipped away as delirium took hold. As disciplined as his mind was, it remained susceptible to the depredations of persistent cold, thirst, and hunger. A short exploration of the surrounding water had discovered a shattered piece of lifeboat. Cirrus clung to it, managing to keep the upper half of himself out of the water to stave off the deadly chill. From the diminishing screams of the Protectorate sailors not far off, it seemed most of them had not been so lucky. The temptation to let go of his fear was strong, his resolve leeching away with every passing hour. What does it matter now? He pondered, too numb to feel the pain of the all-encompassing chill. Let her see it all, the last testament of a dying man. For some reason, Katria's face came to him, as his mental defenses began to erode, threatening to reveal his scheming, his desperate desire for release from this bondage. It was Katria who stopped him. Her face was not the one she wore when he killed her. This was her human face, the pale, frightened visage of the young woman he had sheltered with in the Morsvale sewers.
"Why are they doing this?"
she had whispered to him then, as they huddled beneath a drain cover, listening to the horrors unfolding in the streets above.
What do they want?
He had no answer for her then, but he had one now.
Because they hate us, and they want everything.
He let out a shout as consciousness returned, thrashing in the water and nearly losing his grip on the wreckage.
Hold on to the fear,
he commanded himself, summoning the sensations he had stolen from the drowning spoiled. It was possible there were others in the army who had learned how to mask their thoughts in the same manner, and he was determined not to allow Kathleen to learn the secret.
give her nothing, even if you die here.
So he clung to his flotsam, shivering in fear.